We come tonight to the third in our series on Hebrews chapter 13. We've called the series Exhortation because there's a lot of exhortation in this chapter to us. And it's a challenge to each one of us, these different instructions that we look at week by week. So if you turn to page 212 of the New Testament sections of the Bibles, let's just look at the verse we have before us. Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 3. Remember those who are in prison as though in prison with them. Remember those who are in prison as though in prison with them. Now, if you just glance back in the Bible to verses 32 to 34 of chapter 10, you'll see that what the writer to the Hebrews is doing is urging on these Hebrew Christians to do something that they're already involved with. Chapter 10 and verse 32 says, "Recall the former days when after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to abuse and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on the prisoners, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one." So go on then, says the writer of the Hebrews, doing what you are doing, remembering those in prison. Now most commentators take the view that this particular instruction is written to Christians about Christians, instructing Christians to visit in prison their fellow Christians who've been in prison for their faith. One or two commentators, and I must confess by far and away the minority, think that it's a general instruction. In other words, remember everybody who's in prison. Now, in the context, I think I have to agree with the majority and say that I think probably this verse was particularly referring to Christians in prison for their faith. And we've prayed for modern-day Christians in prison for their faith already this evening. But I want to widen, and you'll be pleased to know that it's with the rector's permission, I'd like to widen the whole of the discussion and think more generally and take it as a watchword, as it were. Remember those in prison, to look at the whole area of prison and imprisonment. And I want to look at a Christian approach to it. So, although stepping beyond the basic meaning of the text, perhaps, nonetheless very much within the spirit of it, and one which I trust you'll see the Christian commitment to. And it's a good moment to do it. In fact, it's a better moment than in about 6 weeks' time, when the London Lectures in Contemporary Christianity would have spent 6 hours talking about crime and the responsible society, when all I could do is echo what the great men have said. At least I can steal the great men's thunder a little bit in this sermon, or at least I hope I can. But perhaps not. Perhaps, in fact, what I'm going to do tonight is to look at the whole thing from a slightly different perspective and maybe open up the whole area about the London Lectures and whet your appetite for what promises to be a very thought-provoking series. Now, this is a topic which concerns us all, as I hope to show shortly. You might not think it does, but I believe that it does profoundly. But first, before I launch in, I perhaps ought to say what my qualifications are for speaking about prisons in the first place. I have spent, I say this advisedly, a day a week in a prison for part of my training when I was training for the ministry. And that day a week spent for a term in a prison taught me a great deal and disillusioned me from several preconceived ideas I had about prisons and imprisonment. So for the rest of this sermon, I want to look at the number of factors which affect the way we as Christians look at the whole area of crime, punishment, and in particular, imprisonment. And now, there are two main areas to what I'm going to say. Our doctrine of man and our doctrine of the church. And we'll see how these both bear on this area. Firstly, our doctrine of man. The longer I go on in the Christian life, the more I realize how a doctrine of man is vital if we're going to make sense of the world. A biblical doctrine of man is essential for interpreting the world in a meaningful way. And this is true of lots of different areas. Those of you who are doing the Koye counselling course at the moment will know that I laid down very firmly at the beginning that if you're going to be a Christian counsellor, you have to have a Christian view of man, a Christian doctrine of man, to do it effectively. And the same is true whether you're interpreting events in the world or, in this case, thinking about crime and punishment. You see, the Christian is neither naively optimistic nor depressingly pessimistic about man. And therefore, he's neither naively optimistic nor depressingly pessimistic about crime and punishment. And that's the first way that our Christian doctrine of man gives us a different perspective. It makes us realists. It makes us look at the facts as they really are. It makes us look at man as he really is. And so the first thing under our doctrine of man is what I've called a realistic view of man's sin. A realistic view of man's sin. Because we know what sort of creatures we are, then we shall avoid optimism of the sort that was rife at the turn of the century. You know, crime will die out as soon as we have an adequate standard of living for everybody. That type of optimism. Events, of course, of our own day have made that sort of prediction rather hollow. And yet there's still that sort of feeling around. It was made with sincerity, but it was sincerely wrong. The Christian view of man is that there is more to the origins of crime, there is more to the origin of sin, than, say, deprivation. However much deprivation may be a factor, it's not the only one. Now, by the same token, the Christian may not be optimistic, but neither may he be cynical. There is hope if we believe in our Lord Jesus Christ. If we believe that the solution to the problem is not found in society alone, and I emphasize alone, but also with the regeneration of the individual, then I think the Christian can avoid cynicism and avoid pessimism and turn to realism of what God can do in a person's life. But we avoid sentimentality and optimism as well. The Christian is a realist. He admits man's a fallen creature, but he acknowledges that man is made in the image of God and therefore can be reborn into the family of God. So we're reminded then that all human nature is fallen, yours and mine, as well as the fellow in Pentonville. You see, in the Christian view, there is no difference between theft, for which a man may be in prison, and adultery, for which he may not, because they are both sins. A Christian view of man doesn't have a gradation of what is sin and what isn't. For God, sin is sin is sin, whether we say you must go to prison for it or not. Therefore, there is no, on one hand, a good society, and on the other, a bad criminal. It's not that we are good and we sentence the bad man to prison. There's no dichotomy like that. We are all sinners in the Christian view of man. It's not that there is a sort of class of person, the criminal class, as it were. No, for the Christian, all have sinned, all have fallen short of the glory of God, whether it happens to be punishable by imprisonment or not. Now, that should have a big effect on the way that we look at the prisoner. It should have a big effect on the way that we think about the criminal. It should have a big effect on the way that we think about prisons. But in fact, sadly, it hasn't. So often in our history. Because the Christian is only a forgiven sinner, then he must realize his solidarity with other sinners who may not yet be forgiven. There but for the grace of God, go I. Or at least, there but for the grace of God, go to prison some of my undetected faults. Do you know that 1 in 5 adult males have committed a sufficiently serious enough crime for it to be on central record? There but for the grace of God, go I. So it causes us then to be realistic about man's sin. Then secondly, our doctrine of man causes us to have a realistic view of man's responsibility. a realistic view of man's responsibility. Man is a responsible being. Incidentally, I'm sorry it's fallen off the edge of the projector there. I designed it for a square one, and this is an oblong projector, so I apologise for that. Man is a responsible being. And part of being a man is the ability to choose for oneself. And that includes the ability to choose to commit crimes. Now, as Christians, we need to keep that in view. It's not just the fault of poor housing. It's not just the fault of poor schooling. It's not just the fault of poor parenting. It's not just the fault of poor environment that causes crime. However these factors may add up to make it more likely. Unless a person's responsibility is diminished through mental illness, a person chooses to do wrong. You see, the Christian believes that man is not just the summation of all the influences that happen to have borne on him. He has a God-given capacity for choice. And that means, of course, that in punishment there is a retributive, I knew I wouldn't say that word properly, retributive factor. There's another one coming up soon which I'll have trouble with as well. Wait for it. Punishment expresses not only society's sorrow, society's desire for the criminal to mend his ways, for reform or for deterrent, but it also expresses the consequences of choosing to be morally wrong. So man is responsible. Now, both these first two things, a realistic view of man's sin and a realistic view of man's responsibility, lead into my third area, which I've called a realistic view of the prisoner. Prisons are dehumanizing places. And Christians need to encourage anything which mitigates the dehumanizing effect of prison. Prison deprives a man of his liberty. After all, that's what it's about. That's the punishment. But within that institution, I believe that we as Christians should make sure that a person is given as much free choice as possible over his own affairs. Given opportunity to work. Given opportunity to earn a living wage. Given opportunity to make restitution to those he's offended. Now, this sort of thing may sound very radical, but I believe that our doctrine of man forces us into this sort of position. You see, if prisons are going to have any sort of positive effect on the lives of criminals, then I believe they're vital to make this sort of reform. If prison is to fit folk for life outside, and the vast majority of people imprisoned aren't in for life, if it's to fit folk for life outside, then it must approximate to life outside. And prisoners banged up in their cells for 23 hours a day because of pressure on the prison system can hardly be said to express a Christian view of man, whatever he may have done. A realistic view of the prisoner. You see, the way we treat someone undergoing imprisonment should be the way we would treat any for whom Christ has died, treating them as full human beings, seeking to prevent the factors which dehumanize, seeking to ensure psychological survival so that they can cope with the outside world again after their release. Let me give you a simple example. When I visited Nottingham Prison, I went into one shop where they were teaching bricklaying. And the guy had built a beautiful fireplace, And it was made of brick, it was beautifully lined, everything was just right with it. And he'd just about finished the day I saw it. And the next day, it would be knocked down. Of course, it had to be, because someone else had to come along and build another fireplace or another brick wall. If you're a typist in an office, how would you like it if at the end of the day, your boss said, "Beautiful typing. You've made a lovely job of that," and tore it up and said, "You can do exactly the same thing again tomorrow. But make sure you do a good job." See what I mean? I believe we've somehow got to so reorganize our prisons that we can take into account that sort of problem, because that's dehumanizing. To allow someone to do a beautiful job and then knock it down doesn't make any sort of sense. We've somehow got to get those people involved in doing things which are going to last, that they can take a pride in, that when they come out, they can do the same. Then there's some chance that if we're treating the people in prison as whole human beings, that they'll behave as whole human beings when they come out back into the community. That leads us, fourthly, to what I've called a realistic view of prisons. From any point of view, Christian or otherwise, prisons do not do what we expect them to do, or what they hope to do themselves. A few statistics, I think, makes that clear enough. In 1976, 73% of all adult male offenders received into prisons had either already been inside or inside some other institution. In other words, 3/4 of the people going into prison had been in either prison or some other residential institution before. In the same year, for every two prisoners, there was one member of staff. That's a high ratio on paper. But even so, reformation is clearly not happening in our prisons. And that was the first thing, I think, which hit me so powerfully. One staff member said to me, "Don't think that prison is a great therapeutic agency. It isn't." And the same chap said, "Prison is effective in that the public is protected." But even that's only true up to a point. Someone has said that 70% of the prison population could be released tomorrow with no threat to the public whatsoever. And I believe that may well be true. I'm not recommending it, but it may well be true. Because so many folk are in for petty theft, for embezzlement, for taking and driving away. They pose no real threat to us as society. And for so many, prison has just become a way of life. A book worth reading is called The Unknown Citizen by Tony Parker. It chronicles the career of a recidivist. I said it correctly. A recidivist is somebody who goes time and time again to prison because he can't cope with the outside world. And as he chronicles the career, if that's the right word, of this inept, pathetic man, he has a total of 26 years of convictions. His total haul from his thefts was £178, and the cost to the taxpayer in prison was £9,200. And in his last offence, he was out of prison one day. He went in. He didn't know what to do with himself. He went onto a station, was seen ripping open a mailbag, and the judge said to him in court, "The society must be protected from people like you. You've already had X previous offences," and sentenced him to 10 years. Now, I believe that that sort of person, and there are many of them in our systems, that sort of person is a case for alternative to prison. To him, prison had become a way of life. There was no way he could live outside of it. And what one needs to see is more non-custodial sentences. Let me just quote you from the director of the National Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders. He said this: "The prognosis for anyone now being committed for some kind of institutional treatment at an early age is appalling. He will probably have a lifetime of association with institutions and be perpetually dependent on social services at enormous cost to the community. We must be able to do better than this. The system, choose people up." In 1972, the Criminal Justice Act brought in a new way of sentencing people, in the start at any rate, in certain selected areas. Non-custodial sentences. For example, a young chap who'd been in Borstal and Approved School, when heard he was being given a non-custodial sentence, said, "Oh dear, I suppose you'll want me to repair old folks' homes." And when in fact he was asked what he'd been good at school, it turned out that not very much, except he had been the swimming champion. And so he was sentenced to helping disabled people to swim. And he was deprived, if you like, of his freedom over his Saturday afternoons or whenever it was. That's the deprivation, that's the punishment. But how much better that than to sentence a fellow to prison, where he may learn worse crime, he may just go round the cycle over and over again. The prospects for fitting the punishment to the crime and making things positive instead of negative are enormous. Sentencing someone who takes and drives away to take and drive away old folks on a Saturday afternoon in a minibus. I'm serious. You deprive a man of his liberty to do what he likes with his Saturdays, but you let him feel part of the community, you let him feel that he's got a part to play, that he's not just the scum of the earth. I believe that a Christian doctrine of man points the way forward to that. What do we do with soccer violence? Did you see them being fined in the courts after the Scotland-England match? Is fining right? Fining's only money, and they've got lots of it. What about sentencing their Saturday afternoons, quite an important time in the life of a soccer fan, to do something useful for the community? Yes, there's deprivation, which implies society's condemnation of what's been done. But there's something constructive to make a person feel that he's worthwhile. Huge administration cost? Yes, indeed. But if it prevents that person from offending again, then we save ourselves untold thousands in the future. In economic, in social, in humane terms, it makes sense that the punishment of criminals should take place as far as possible in the community. Now, clearly, prison is the only way forward for the violent, serious criminal. But if prisons were less pressured with short-term people, people on remand, and so on, then there might be some hope of them doing something concrete and constructive, and not just a holding operation. The Church of England Board of Social Responsibility concluded its report with these words. Within the overall pattern of penal... Can't read my own writing. Penal treatment. Within the overall pattern of penal treatment, prisons should be used as sparingly as possible, and with the recognition that for the most part it creates as many problems, both for society and for the prisoner, as it solves. And in my limited experience, I would say that that was true. But so often Christians are prepared to make do with the status quo. What the eye doesn't see, the heart doesn't grieve over. What then should we do as Christians? And that brings me to my second main area, what I've called the doctrine of the church. Our doctrine of the church, I think, points to two roles, two important roles of the church in this area. One is I've called a prophetic role, and the other I've called the pastoral role. First of all, the prophetic role. And in this role, I think, this role is exercised, I think, in three areas. Firstly, in the area of changing prisons. I haven't expanded greatly, partly because of the length, on what's wrong with the prison system. But I think I've said sufficient to indicate some of the areas which worry me, and I trust worry you as well. And I believe that the church needs to be in the forefront of the movement for change in prisons. The church is in a unique position, you see, because the church wants to stand firmly as well for its commitment to what is right and its commitment to what is wrong. We're not saying that we must be soft on people who do wrong. We're not saying that we mustn't sentence them. We're not saying we mustn't condemn them in the courts, no. We're committed to the fact that sin is sin and man is responsible for that sin. But by the same token, because we believe in the dignity of man, we need to stand firm by our view that the prisoner needs treating as a human being, that we afford him all his rights, that we give him all the decencies that are involved in being human, and that we ensure that rather than deteriorating away in prison, that he has the opportunity to develop as a person and to change in a way that's consonant with the deprivation of his liberty that his punishment demands. Let me give you one small but far-reaching example of what I mean. I don't know if you know, but prisoners in our prisons work for peanuts. Not literal peanuts, but very small amounts of money. A few years ago, when I was visiting Nottingham, it was a few pounds a week. If we treat people like children and give them pocket money, it's no wonder they behave like children. If when a prisoner builds a wall or tends a garden, we give him the rate for the job, and then we tax him like everybody else is taxed, and then we make him provide for his family like everyone else provides for their family, and we make him pay for his food and clothing like everyone else pays for their food and clothing, he'll be much better equipped to do that when he returns to society. You see, part of the problem with prison is that you get this dreadful institutionalization business, whereby gradually the person becomes so dependent on the system that he cannot function without the system. And if we want people to function well in society, we need to make prison like society and treat people as human beings. We need to change prisons. That's one example. There are many others that one could think of. But secondly, we need to change society. The church has a prophetic role to change society. Now, I've already said that I'm firmly convinced that it's not just social conditions which cause a person to be a criminal. But on the other hand, those conditions do add to the likelihood that that person will turn to crime of some form or another. If you were brought up as a teenager on an estate which has nowhere to play except the streets, then it's likely that you'll play on the street. And it's likely that you will kick a litter bin in. And then you'll be called a vandal. Now, I'm not saying that because there's no playground, that person was bound to kick the litter bin in. He chooses whether he kicks the litter bin in or not. And we must condemn him for kicking the litter bin in. But if there had been a playground where he could kick a ball around, it would be less likely that he would choose to kick a litter bin in. Do you see what I mean? And Christians need to be in the forefront of pointing to areas of social concern which affect this area. And too often it's left to secular organizations to do this. But our doctrine of man and our doctrine of the church demands that we speak in this way, prophetically, to our society. Then thirdly, what I've called changing public opinion. Public opinion is always fickle, and none more so than in the area of crime and punishment. You only have to have a particularly obnoxious crime for everyone to scream about longer prison sentences, stricter regimes in prison, and so on. But you only have to have someone escape from prison by a daring escape for everyone secretly, deep down, to be really rather admiring people like Frank Wilson and so on. Public opinion is fickle. And the call for longer sentences and stricter regimes in prison is a gut reaction. And I think Christians need to be aware that it's a gut reaction. It's a reaction of revenge. Bertrand Russell said, "We never feel so good as when we're punishing someone." I found that a very telling quotation. We never feel so good as when we're punishing someone. And that's a warning to us, isn't it? If you find a gut reaction coming out, beware. Winston Churchill said this, "The mood and temper of the public with regard to the treatment of crime and criminals is one of the most unfailing tests of the civilization of any country." I think you'll find Charles Colson will quote that as well. It's a profound quote. "The mood and temper of the public with regard to the treatment of crime and criminals is one of the most unfailing tests of civilization of any country." In other words, we need as Christians to be educating public opinion so that revulsion of the sin doesn't result in rejection of the sinner. We can be revolted against the crime, but that doesn't mean we take vengeance on the sinner. Yes, we punish them. Yes, we let the law have its course. But let's ensure that our motives are clean, and we don't just want to see someone punished out of a sense of revenge. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will repay. You see, justice always should be tempered with mercy, because that's the way that God treats us. God will no means, says the Bible, clear the guilty. But he's merciful and slow to anger with those who repent. And can we be anything less than that? Because we should have the mind of Christ. There's a parable about that somewhere. A prophetic role. Then finally, what I've called a pastoral role. And this is something for everybody, for each individual Christian to get involved with. Our lesson from Matthew 25 and our text, remember those in prison, as though in prison with them, points this up. Jesus said, I was in prison and you visited me. What can you do? Well, quickly, a list, because I realize my time is gone. Firstly, there's a pastoral role towards those involved, towards the prisoner, towards the prisoner's family, and towards the prison staff. In 1974, I can't speak for today, but in 1974 at Nottingham Prison, prisoners were released at 7 a.m. without breakfast, with £4, and with a travel warrant. I think that's inhuman and certainly non-Christian. But it was an opportunity for someone to show Christian charity, and the chaplain met any prisoner who was not being met by anyone else and took him home for breakfast. And maybe you don't live near a prison, maybe you don't have that sort of contact. But you see the point I'm making? There's an area where Christian charity needs to be seen in action. Why don't you become a prison visitor or become involved in activities where prisoners are taking part or where you have opportunity to go into prisons? Why don't you get involved with the Prisoners' Christian Fellowship that's starting up in this country? And maybe in time to come, if not now, you may live in a community where there are prisoners' families nearby. The wife often has the hardest sentence. One wife said, next time send me to prison and let him work and look after the kids. Because she knew who got the toughest deal. It's a huge area, not for patronising, but for real practical help. Then the ones with the real life sentence, the prison officers and the prison staff. They are there for life. And we need to support and understand them. And the public needs to do that, in particular the Christian public. But then there's the area of employment. Are you in personnel? What about employment? It's likely that you won't touch a convict. I personally believe that's wrong as a Christian. If a man has been convicted and served a sentence, surely the Christian responsibility is to forgive and to give a new start. That's what God has done for us. There's a parable about that somewhere. Okay, it's a risk. But isn't it a risk when you take anybody on? Christians need to be seen to believe in forgiveness and not just talk about it. One convict said, the judge gave me 5 years and I deserved it, but the public has given me a life sentence. Christians need to be forgiving in this area. Then in the community, what would you say if they decided to open a hostel for released prisoners next door to you? I trust, as a Christian, you would see it as an opportunity, not as a threat. But my guess is that without prior thought, you wouldn't. When I was in Sheffield, they opened at the back of us a home for mentally handicapped people as a sort of halfway house to get them back into the community. And the person who was in the house next door was a member of our church. And she was asked by some other people in the road to get up a petition to prevent the council putting these people into this house. And she refused, to her eternal credit, because she saw the opportunity as a Christian to be involved in the community. Then lastly, but by no means least, what about prayer? Pray for those involved in this area. Pray for Christian legal people. Pray for Christian probation officers. Pray for Christian prison staff, Christian social workers, all of whom are working in this area. And pray for them and for those whom they're in contact with. And if you don't remember those in prison in any other way, remember them in prayer. I hope I've whetted your appetite for the London lectures over these next 6 weeks, because I think it's an area we all need to come to terms with. But let me just leave you with a quotation. A quotation from a prisoner who was released into a caring Christian community. Last Christmas, as my wife and I queued up for communion, I find myself alongside an ex-detective inspector, also a Christian. And as we knelt down together at the altar, I saw something of what being a Christian was all about. Remember those in prison, as though in prison with them. Thank you. I'd like to reply to that, actually, because I think it's a very important point. The lady said, what about the victims? And I couldn't agree more. I believe our Christian doctrine of man that I've been talking about means that we see all people, whether convicted criminals or whether the victims, as people for whom Christ died. And our attitude towards the victim should be identical to that towards the criminal, one of love and concern. And I believe that Christians should be involved in that area as well, profoundly involved. In fact, you may have missed, but I did in fact say that I believe that criminals should take part in restitution and reparation and have opportunity to do so by earning a living wage in prison so that they can do that. Now let's just have a moment of silence to reflect. Help me, dear Lord, to love thee more with heart and soul and mind, that so I may fulfill thy will by loving all mankind. Amen.